Thank you for standing by, and welcome to Santo 2021 half-year results question and answer conference call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. The call will begin with Mr. Kevin Gallagher, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer, providing some opening remarks, and we will then move straight to Q&A with both Kevin Gallagher and Anthony Neilson, Chief Financial Officer. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Kevin Gallagher, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome to the Santos half-year results question and answer call. Joining me is our CFO, Anthony Neilson. Anthony and I recorded a video presentation on today's results, which you can find on our website, along with the presentation pack. I do recommend that you watch the video if you get the time, as it is certainly riveting viewing. We're not going to repeat the video presentation on this call. We will, however, be happy to take your questions. But before we do that, let me make a few brief opening remarks. Let me start by saying that I'm pleased to present another strong set of financial results that demonstrate the strengths of our disciplined, low-cost operating model. Good operational and cost performance delivered $572 million of free cash flow and underlying profit of $317 million. This was despite lower average LNG prices due to the lagged oil linkage in our long-term offtake contracts. The board has declared an interim dividend of 5.5 US cents per share, fully franked, a significant increase from the previous interim. The dividend represents 20% of free cash flow and is consistent with our sustainable dividend policy, which targets a range of between 10 to 30% payout of free cash flow. The business performed well in the first half, and I'd particularly like to call out a record first half production and sales volumes, which enabled us to increase guidance to the upper part of the range. Our sales revenue increased 22% to just over $2 billion, which is a record for the first half. Our lower unit production costs. Focus on safe, low cost and efficient operations is continuing to drive reductions and is reflected in production costs of $7.97 per barrel of oil equivalent. I am pleased that our continued focus on costs sees a lowering of our production cost guidance despite cost challenges across the industry. EBITDAX was up 24% to $1.2 billion, driven by higher oil prices and lower unit costs. And our value accretive low-cost supply of offshore infill projects at Van Gogh and Bayu-Undan have delivered excellent results with strong initial production rates into our existing infrastructure. And finally, our very successful maiden debt issue in the US 144A market, where we raised $1 billion at a very competitive long-term interest rate. This was an excellent result for Santos and showed strong support from the capital markets for our disciplined growth strategy and industry-leading ESG position. We have now delivered more than $4 billion in free cash flow since 2016. And to recap, between 2016 and now, we've had to navigate two oil price crashes, an earthquake in PNG, a global pandemic, and ongoing government threats of intervention in domestic gas markets. This demonstrates the strength and the resilience of our portfolio and our disciplined local cost operating model. In 2021, we are targeting a free cash flow break-even oil price before hedging at around $25 per barrel, the same level as last year. At current oil prices, we would generate over $1.1 billion in free cash flow this year. And for every $10 the oil price is above our free cash flow break-even price, the portfolio generates around $330 million in free cash flow before hedging. When I spoke to you in December at our Investor Day, I set out five strategic priorities for this year. I am pleased to say that we have ticked off three of these already, and the fourth, to FID the Moomba CCS project, is on track for the second half as promised. Our first priority, of course, is maintaining a safe and strong base business, with a free cash flow break-even of less than $25 per barrel. We want to keep the business functioning efficiently and keep it low cost, and that's what our long-life assets with steady production profiles allow us to do. All activities within that base business are self-funded within the rules of our disciplined operating model. The second priority was to take FID on Barossa, which we did in March. Barossa is a world-class LNG project with a very competitive cost of supply into Asian markets. Barossa fits perfectly with our strategy for disciplined growth utilising existing infrastructure around our core assets. It is also a tangible benefit of our acquisition of the ConocoPhillips assets in the region, and it is one of the lowest cost new LNG projects in the world and will give Santos and Darwin LNG a competitive advantage in a tightening LNG market. We are targeting a cash cost of production of around $2 per MMBTU, including the FPSO service contract costs. Barossa is basically an offshore scope with an FPSO and a pipeline tied into the existing Darwin LNG plant. Importantly, around 80% of the capital cost is protected under fixed price contracts, so we are not materially exposed to cost pressures seen across this industry. And the project is off to a great start, with first steel cut for the FPSO turret in July, and manufacturing of subsea flow lines and trees already underway. We are on track for first gas in the first half of 2025. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our Barossa partner, SKENS, for their support in taking FID earlier this year. And we're also finalising the sale and purchase agreement for JERA to acquire a 12.5% interest in Barossa. Our third priority was to take FID on the Moomba CCS project. CCS is the key pathway technology to achieving our medium-term emissions reduction targets, with the Moomba project now ready to take FID. All we need is for CCS to be eligible for carbon credit units in Australia. We're extremely encouraged by the draft methodology released by the Clean Energy Regulator for qualification for Australian carbon credit units. With that consultation process now complete, everything remains on track for the government process to be completed in the next month, and then we will deliver on our commitment of taking FID on our Moomba CCS project. Moomba is the lowest cost and one of the largest CCS projects globally, as it benefits from existing separation equipment and depleted gas reservoirs with proven rock seal. We forecast a life cycle cost of less than $24 per tonne of CO2. Moomba CCS paves the way for a significant carbon reduction story for Santos and for Australia. It also means we are able to explore a three-hub CCS strategy that covers Moomba, Bayu-Undan and potentially offshore Western Australia. This infrastructure footprint potentially provides more than 30 million tonnes per annum of CCS capacity across three Santos-operated hubs. Moomba will be the first project to hit the go button, but I am especially excited about the potential we have to repurpose Bayu-Undan as a CCS hub in the region. We estimate a storage capacity of around 10 million tonnes of CO2 per annum in Bayu-Undan once production from the field ceases. Our studies indicate existing wells and pipeline can be repurposed for CO2 service. And I would remind you that at Bayu-Undan project startup, over 1 BCF of gas a day was injected into these high permeability reservoirs, so they are some of the best offshore reservoirs in the region for gas injection. Bayu-Undan CCS would contribute to decarbonising Barossa from project startup, as well as opening up other resource opportunities and complementary industry opportunities in Northern Australia. We look forward to working with our joint venture partners and our host government to bring an exciting project to fruition. Fourth priority was to launch FEED on the Dorado oil and gas project, which we did in June. We plan to develop Dorado in two phases, an initial liquids phase followed by a future gas development, providing supply into our domestic gas infrastructure in Western Australia. Entering FEED is a significant milestone and has the project on track for FID around the middle of next year for the Phase 1 liquids development. FID on the second phase of gas development to backfill our domestic gas infrastructure in WA is likely to occur in the second half of the decade. Dorado is a very low CO2 reservoir and with approximately 1.5% CO2 and with all gas reinjected in the initial phase. This makes it one of the lowest emissions intensity oil projects in the region. Potential tie-in opportunities to Dorado, starting with the Pavo and Apis prospects to be drilled early next year, could easily be tied back into the Dorado infrastructure and materially increase the value of the project. The fifth priority, and the one we have not been able to progress as planned, was to commence appraisal drilling at Narrabri. While Narrabri achieved state and federal environmental approvals last year, an appeal has been lodged against the state approval. A hearing on the appeal is scheduled for later this month, with a final decision not expected until the end of the year. The proposed merger with Oil Search is consistent with our disciplined strategy to grow around our core assets. It represents a compelling combination of two industry leaders to create an unrivaled regional champion of size and scale with a unique diversified portfolio of long-life, low-cost oil and gas assets. The merged company would have strong cash generation from a diverse range of assets, which provides a strong platform for sustainable growth and shareholder returns. The merger also builds on our industry-leading approach to ESG through the combination of Santos' net zero pathway with Oil Search's unique social and community investment programs in PNG. As I have previously said, I believe that our industry must be in a position to self-fund growth and the energy transition to cleaner fuels. I believe this merger will create a company which is better placed to achieve this goal than either of us stand alone. I also believe the merger will unlock material shareholder value in three key areas. First, substantial combination synergies to the benefit of all shareholders, using Santos' proven ability to deliver incremental value. Second, through partner alignment in PNG to unlock incremental value, just as we have achieved at Darwin LNG and Barossa following the Conoco acquisition and subsequent sell downs. And third, options and flexibility for portfolio optimization in the merged group, including continuing with Oil Search's sell down process in Alaska. We are currently undertaking exclusive due diligence on each other and expect this will be complete by the end of this month and are targeting to have the scheme vote and all approvals in place before the end of the year, which will position the merged company to hit the ground running at the start of the following year. Santos has a proven track record in delivering integration synergies from acquisitions. Both the Quadrant and ConocoPhillips acquisitions delivered over $160 million in synergies from areas like duplicated overhead and corporate costs and OPEX and CAPEX savings through applying our low-cost operating model. From the Oil Search merger, we will use the same approach and the same team, which we expect will deliver significant synergies for the benefit of all shareholders. We will be able to provide further guidance on potential synergies once we have completed due diligence. Now, something I've been very pleased with this year has been our success in delivering incremental value from assets that we have acquired. In the case of both Bayu-Undan Phase 3C and Van Gogh Infill Phase 2, these are projects that represent upside value over and above our acquisition cases. They are perfect examples of our strategy to deliver incremental value from short-cycle, low-risk opportunities around our core assets using existing infrastructure. Both projects have delivered better than expected reservoir outcomes and strong initial flow rates from the first wells. We look forward to completing the remaining four wells on these projects over the course of the second half. This focus on driving incremental value from the assets is something we will bring to the Oil Search merger. In summary, it was a strong start to the year for Santos. The business is performing well, and our operating model sets us up for disciplined growth. The potential merger with Oil Search creates an exciting opportunity to create a regional champion of size and scale. And with size and scale comes the opportunity to accelerate our aspiration to becoming a clean fuels company and reaching our net zero commitment by 2040. With that brief opening, we'd now be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from James Redfern from Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi, Kevin. I hope you're well. Just want to ask a couple of questions about the proposed merger with Oil Search. Assuming the merger goes ahead, Santos will have a 42.5% equity interest in PNG LNG. I was just wondering, would Santos be happy with that level of equity in the project, or would you be interested in selling down? I guess if you were looking to sell down, what would be Santos's ideal equity interest in PNG LNG? And I've got one more after that. Thank you.
Well, look, I mean, I think all I would say on that, James, and by the way, thanks for the question, is that I think when you put the two companies together, it gives you the opportunity for portfolio optimization, and we've said that from day one. 42.5 is a very high equity level in a project, so that in itself creates the opportunity for further alignment in PNG and the ability to optimize that portfolio, strengthen the balance sheet, and support the growth plans going forward. Look, I'm not going to say what the ideal equity level in the project would be. I think, for any particular asset, we'd only talk about that once we're in that position where we know what the opportunities look like.
Okay, thank you. Well, I mean, I might try one more in relation to the Alaskan oil assets. Any comments you can make around your view on those assets and whether you'd be happy to give up operatorship of the Pikka unit, assuming the merger goes ahead, and the proposed sell down. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, look, I mean, what we've said is we'll continue with Oil Search's sell down. We believe that perhaps we can have more flexibility than was offered previously during the sell downs, we're not wed to operatorship of any asset if the deal's right at the end of the day. And that includes in our current portfolio today. I think all I would say is that we'll continue with Oil Search's plans to sell down, and we'd be very flexible on what that would look like in terms of operatorship.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, Kevin. That's all.
Thank you. Thanks, James.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Dale Coenders from Barrenjoey. Please go ahead.
Morning, gentlemen. On the slide that mentions that on PNG LNG, the JV's recommenced discussions in July on expansion, and obviously you flagged the strategic rationale to realign JV interests. Is there also scope to revise the current proposal of the two small trains? Are stakeholders open to this? I'd assume there's obviously greater value and greater capital efficiency if you can bring Total into the foundation project to move back to larger train designs.
Well, look, I mean, I think that's all yet to be seen, right? And I wouldn't want to predict how any of that plays out, Dale. I think the bottom line is that, you know, all of those options are there, you know, in terms of looking at how we optimise the portfolio, how we optimise the equity positions, and how we optimise the development projects going forward. We're going through the DD process right now, and in that we're getting a better understanding of the expansion project. But it's too early to make comments like that. I'm actually surprised at your question, Dale. I thought you were calling up to say I told you so about Arcadia and how good Arcadia feels developing, which I would have had to give you credit for, mate. But, sorry, that's all I can really say on the PNG stuff at this stage.
Okay, I might try my luck not on Arcadia, but on the synergies. It sounds like you're trying to avoid quantifying them, but can you talk about the areas for cost synergies? Is it just around corporate costs from Oil Search, or is there other areas given there's limited gas marketing when we're trying to think about how big these could be?
Look, I mean, most people think of synergies in terms of just people, right? People synergies. And sure, there's a component of that. But as we saw both with Quadrant and with ConocoPhillips, we were able to realise significant synergies, not only in the corporate areas, but in areas like IT, our direct OPEX. You know, one of the benefits of having a number of facilities, midstream and upstream facilities that we operate, is that we can centralise a lot of the engineering and maintenance planning efforts, and we get scale benefits that are quite considerable. And we've seen that across many of the assets that we're operating here around Australia now. You know, if you think most oil and gas companies have one or two assets to operate, we've got seven midstream assets we operate around Australia, and that's been able to realise very significant, or we've been able to realise very significant scale synergies and benefits from that. And then there's other things contractual. You know, with scale, you typically get better global contracting arrangements and outcomes, and we've been able to see benefits there also, as we've brought in the Conoco and the Quadrant organisations into Santos.
Interest, insurance, treasury sort of areas, Dale. So across the board, little bits and pieces, and they all add up as we start to, you know, get inside and have a look. But we're in the middle of due diligence at the moment, so we're still going through to get that quantification. So we want to try and do that at the end of the DD period.
And so when we look at the sort of synergies that we realised in both those previous acquisitions, we can see significant potential here. And you're right, I don't want to give guidance on that yet until we've completed the DD process, because, you know, there's always pluses and minuses when you go through DD and these things. And then we'll give the most accurate guidance we can once we're in a position to do so, hopefully in just a few weeks' time.
Okay. Thanks, gentlemen, and well done on the result.
Cheers. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Mark Samter from MST. Please go ahead.
Yeah, morning, guys. I've got three, if that's not taking the mickeys too much. First one on just a bit more detail on the infrastructure slide. Obviously, and particularly Carney, I presume, with their permission, giving us details around the financials of the Total deal. I'm curious whether someone getting 9x EV/EBITDA for what is it purely a financial instrument, okay, you carry volume risk, but you're not giving up any operational control or any operational impact whatsoever. Has that changed the way you view some of that more core infrastructure? And I'm also curious just whether there's any change in timeline expectations on the infrastructure with the Allsearch transaction, or are you still full steam ahead?
Well, Mark, as you would know, my CFO doesn't show a lot of emotion, but he gets very excited talking about infrastructure. So I'm going to throw that one over to him because he likes talking about it. So, Anthony.
Thanks, Mark. Look, that's a look-through like-for-like that we've sort of had to back-calculate from the Total Energies transaction, but it's a pretty close proxy to the value that they got, which was $95 million of EBITDA per annum. So I think you're right. It shows that there is appetite out there for a sort of 9 to 10 times transaction that is largely a synthetic financial instrument, like you said. So it was a very good value point for us to be able to sort of show what we've been talking about now for the past year. Because as you said, I think it was in your note that that EBITDA in our portfolio is trading at 4 to 5 times. So if we can unleash that incremental multiple of an extra 5 times on a $500 million EBITDA business, including GLNG, then you know, you're potentially looking at quite a significant value uplift of over $2 billion if you just apply that multiple. So I think it does show that there's appetite out there. It shows that there's money out there. It gives us the flexibility and the options as another source of capital as well. In terms of the last part of your question, look, I think it's something that when MergeCo goes ahead, that we need to look at in the tools that we have around all of balancing out all of the capital management we have across all the different projects, and as Kevin said, looking at the alignment across the projects as well. So I think this is still on the agenda for us. It's just going to be in part of a bigger portfolio.
Thanks, and I guess my next couple of questions actually kind of tie into that last point as well. And I'm just curious, with the Dorado sell down, is there logic to finding out how much of Alaska you A, want to keep, and B, end up keeping, just from a kind of portfolio balance perspective, how much liquids you want in the portfolio,
Well, look, I mean, I think that's a good question. I mean, sometimes the timing of these events kind of take care of them themselves, but look, ultimately, we're looking to have a balanced portfolio. We've always said that. We like the idea of having a certain share of our portfolio that's fixed price domestic gas contracts. We want a certain share or exposure to the LNG markets. And of course, then you've got your liquids markets that we like to have an exposure to as well. And so having a balance in the portfolio, not too dominated by any one, is important to us. And we've seen the benefits of that through the cycle. When oil price has crashed in recent years, those fixed price domestic gas contracts come to the fore. And obviously when oil price goes up, our LNG and our oil or liquids products then sort of carry the weight of the revenue stream. So we do want a good balance, and we don't want to be too exposed to anyone. But yeah, to answer your question specifically, yes, looking at what you may end up being left with in Alaska falling oil searches sell down process would be an important consideration.
And then just last quick one, and so this is a bit of a kind of wanky big picture one, and it is putting the cart before the horse because I haven't even got all search yet, let alone done any asset sell downs. But I guess there's a world where you do sell down a reasonable size stake in PNG LNG, and all of a sudden the business is, arguably can go pretty rapidly towards no debt. I'm 10,000% with you with the ability that these companies need to be able to fund themselves. But do you have a view on what you think is a optimal balance sheet for an E&P in the go-forward world? I mean, no debt's inefficient. Do you have in your mind where you would ideally like to see the balance sheet look in 12, 24 months post-completion?
Well, look, I mean, I think we've said historically that 20 to 30 range is a great place to be through the cycle from a gearing perspective, and probably targeting around 25%. Going forward, that might be more in the 20 to 25% range as a much healthier place to be, because you're right, you don't want to get too lazy and have a lazy balance sheet. But I think what we want as an organization has got enough cash flow generation that we're effectively funding or are able to fund our growth projects, pay a dividend and self-fund all of our sustaining capex within that and not be too leveraged when inevitably the commodity cycles turn against you.
Perfect. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Tom Allen from UBS. Please go ahead.
Afternoon, Kevin and Anthony. Question on CCS. So given the Moomba gas plant is currently emitting 2.3 million tonnes per annum, and Beach have indicated their intention to opt in for their share of the project, how come the scope is still only for a 1.7 million tonne project rather than all the emissions from the plant? And can you just confirm which specific reservoir will be first targeted for CCS?
Yeah, look, I mean, the emissions that we're capturing are reservoir emissions. So the reservoir, the emissions that get separated out at Moomba, but they come from the reservoir. We still have what we call combustion emissions. So the emissions that come from running the power plants at Moomba, and we're not capturing those yet. So we'd have to have economic post-combustion carbon capture technology available to that, which I might talk about later. But so it's the 1.7 million that come from the reservoirs that we're capturing, and then we're injecting them into the upstream reservoirs. And the first one, I can't actually remember the specific fuel, but as we've said before, we have something like 20 million tons per annum of Cooper capacity for the next 50 years. It's available to us across all of those reservoirs across the Cooper Basin. Sorry, it's just come back to me. Strzelecki. So it's the Strzelecki field that we're injecting into initially.
Sure.
That's phase one. And that I think that gives us the first 7 to 10 years, I think, before we have to move to an adjacent reservoir. So we've got a lot of reservoirs all sitting there, depleted over the years. Got a great inventory, and I believe it won't be too long until we start to share that capacity with you, just the same way we book reserves today. We're working through the PRMS to start to accredit that storage capacity, and that'll be booked in the not too distant future and be part of our annual reserves and I suppose capacity statements that we'll put out. We also have another project in the Cooper Basin, our upstream nodal optimization project, which we're just going through the final stages of approving internally. Over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, we will be electrifying, as part of a larger Cooper electrification project, but electrifying some of our compression and power gen in the upstream satellites. What that does is that allows us to bring more CO2 then back to Moomba, that is currently where the gas is currently being consumed to drive the compression and the power gen at the upstream satellites today. And by bringing that back to Moomba, Darwin would be one heck of a pipeline. Bring that back to Moomba, we'll then add to that 1.7 million tonnes over time. And so that's something we'll be doing over the next few years. And not only will that bring us more CO2 to inject and generate more carbon credits, what it will also do, and this is very important, is it will produce more sales gas because we'll burn less gas for power gen. And essentially be running poles and wires from the Moomba power facilities to operate those upstream facilities.
Sure, thanks, Kevin. And then based on your read of the draft legislation from the Clean Energy Regulator, do you think you'd still be eligible for Australian carbon credit units if you saw a little bit of incremental production from injecting CO2 underground via enhanced oil recovery?
Well, look, I mean, the regs and the legislation is focused on CCS, not CCUS. You know, if that happens in the future, that'll be the case. But our project is built to only inject and store and permanently store the CO2. So that's what we are focused on. We're not focused on enhanced recovery of any fuels. Our focus here on this project is purely as a carbon capture and storage project.
Sure. And then just lastly, on your plan to build out the scale midstream business, can you describe, you're pointing to potentially beefing up the EV with the synthetic toll from GLNG, but can you describe how you might bring the CCS project into the scope of the midstream EV and how we should think about open access tolling on carbon sequestration and how the value of ACCUs might be shared?
Well, look, in the Cooper Basin, that's going to be a bit more restricted, right? Because it's not close to other industries. It's not close to a lot of other fields other than the Cooper Basin operators that we have today. So I don't anticipate a lot of third-party CO2 being transported into the Cooper Basin. That said, Santos is investing in direct air capture technology, both post-combustion and direct air capture, and looking to get a target price there below $50 Australian per tonne to capture. And if we're able to achieve that in the years ahead, depending on carbon price, then that opens up the opportunity to offset other people's emissions in the Cooper Basin. And given we have such a large capacity there, up to 20 million tonnes per annum capacity, that creates future offsetting or tolling opportunities for us in the Cooper, and we are very excited about that opportunity for the longer term. But the carbon price isn't there yet. It's not there to make that economic yet. But we do believe that will happen in the years ahead, not too far into the future. DLNG, however, is a bit different. So when we look at the Bayu-Undan CCS opportunity that we're pursuing, that would be looking to take around 2.3 million tonnes from Barossa and Darwin every year. But it has a capacity of up to 10 million tonnes per annum. And so we're looking at other projects in the region there, and third-party access there is an opportunity. And that can become a very lucrative opportunity, not only for oil and gas projects, but for other industries in the Darwin area that could or would be emitters. And so we see that as a real exciting opportunity. There's a bit of work to do in that, but all the studies so far are very encouraging. We've got a number of MOUs with our partners, both at Darwin and Bayu-Undan. We're working with the Australian and the Timor-Leste regulators on this project. I believe it's a very exciting project. Bit of water to go under the bridge yet on that one, but if we're able to get that up, I think that is a very exciting opportunity.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Adam Martin from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Just first question there, just on Van Gogh. You know, you've disclosed a pretty good flow rate, 23,000 barrels a day. You know, you got reserves there of 10 million barrels back in 2020. Are there any reserve implications here?
No, we wouldn't have thought so at this stage. Obviously, if there's an outperformance, that would change it. But at this point, it's pretty much in line with
the carrying. The two P numbers are in the presentation, Adam, in page 16, which was VG was 10 million barrels gross a year.
That's right.
Yep, okay. And production costs in Northern Australia, about $70 million a quarter, obviously coming down nicely. Is that the sort of new run rate from here, or are you expecting to lower that again?
From an OPEX perspective, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. So, look, we're definitely in the bottom end of the range, so I think that's obviously the place we'd like to be. The range is 790 to 830. The reason it's got a bit of flex in the range is obviously FX, as I said in the presentation, and has sort of been pushing us a little bit higher, particularly in the onshore assets in Cooper Basin, although FX seems to have eased off a bit in the second half, which is good news. So the lower FX rate helps us from that sense. So that will hopefully, the easing of the FX helps us keep towards the bottom end of that range. And the other thing that hit us hard in the first half, and obviously it's hard to see the impacts of it in the second half, is COVID costs, such as quarantining in particular, and extra sort of security and sanitisation costs, et cetera, across the organisation. So those
particularly for Northern Australia?
Yeah, particularly Northern Australia with the Bay Undan field, because it's offshore, and we've got Timorese people as well coming onto the platform. So those two things aside, yes, that is the trajectory on a normalised basis. So taking those things out is in the bottom end and coming down.
Okay, and final question just on the merger, just due diligence. I mean, if you have to describe the sort of one or two key focus areas there, what would they be?
Look, I mean, in due diligence, I never try and predict what the key focus areas are going to be, because there can always be surprises. But it goes without saying, we know PNG LNG very well, and so it's really around Papua and Alaska at the end of the day from an asset perspective.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. That's all for me.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Saul Kavanagh from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, gents. Three unrelated questions, if I may. Firstly, just on the Bay Undan carbon capture and storage project, are you able to give a ballpark idea of what you're expecting in break-even costs there? And can you also provide colour on where it sits with the regulator in terms of baselines for the emissions there? And are they going in a direction where they're going to potentially demand CCS rather than it just being a kind of optional voluntary action on your part?
Okay, thanks for that, Saul. I think the first thing to kind of point out there is, well, let me just say, not in a position to give cost guidance on that yet, because we're working through all of that, except to say it looks very competitive. And the reason for that is that much of the infrastructure is already in place, the pipeline, the offshore facilities, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot in place, and if everything's CO2 compatible, then that reduces a lot of costs. So there's some plant would be required at Darwin, but that could be offset with some reductions in plant requirements offshore at Barossa, and with some changes to scope to the Barossa project that would sort of compensate some of those costs. So we see it as being a very competitive project, very competitive with price, but not in a place to give guidance yet. We want to work through with our joint venture partners and get it up to a point of maturity before we do that. In terms of your second point to that question, I'm not sure if that's one, that's two of your three, or that's just one of your three, but the second part of your first one, if that's what it is, on the regulatory stuff. Look, I think the first thing to recognise is Barossa is an approved project. It's already approved. The baseline process is a very different process, and it's mechanical. How baselines are calculated is a mechanical process. And so, today, Barossa has got a baseline for offshore, and Darwin's got a baseline for onshore. And Darwin's baseline has been set currently as the Bay Undan baseline, but the baseline for Darwin when Barossa comes online would be very much in line with the one it has today. It would be very similar baseline it would get. That's how we've set it up. And then hence, Barossa has an offshore baseline that's set around the reservoir emission levels offshore. And so we're very confident in what that looks like. And of course, any sort of carbon price assumptions we've taken account of in the economics anyway for that project. The key here, though, is that there will be no requirements as part of that baseline to do CCS. That's my point, because the project's already approved. The baselines for each project are resubmitted, I think, every 5 years. And so it doesn't matter what project you're in. You don't get a baseline for life. They're resubmitted every 5 years. And we'll go through that. And it's got to be 3 years from startup, I think, is when you get your official baseline. And so we will get that at that point in time. 12 months or so before startup, that will be confirmed. The point of CCS, though, is then it doesn't matter. If we do CCS, we want to make money out of CCS, just like we believe we will at the Cooper Basin, number one. But number two, importantly, with CCS, Barossa becomes a very low carbon intensity project. And that's our ultimate aim here, is to be able to, and we've always said, once the government qualifies carbon capture and storage projects for ACCUs, it's our belief that these projects will become very valuable projects and we'll see a lot more of them.
Thanks. My other questions regarding the oil search merger, to the extent you can share, I wanted to understand the thinking about the concentration with PNG country risk and how you'll address credit rating agency and auditor concerns on that front, and particularly around, I mean, could the merge co essentially be under pressure from those kind of agencies to sell down in PNG rather than it being a voluntary portfolio optimization, as you characterised it?
Yeah, thanks, Saul. Yeah, look, we've done a lot of work, obviously, through the banks in the lead up to the merger and through the DD that we're doing now. As you know, most of the big banking companies, the big bulge brackets, have sort of internal credit rating views on how to calculate that. So we're pretty comfortable with the country risk score as a diversified company. It doesn't really restrict us on the notching scales from S&P from all the work we've done. And we'll go through a process with S&P, obviously, and we're in constant engagement with them around how that's going to work. So from that regard, we're not worried at all from a country risk perspective. I think the important bit that it does do is, though, as Kevin said, there's always the potential for the alignment across the organisation of MergeCo. And S&P always look at those levers that you've got, the ability that you can move things around, optimise things, sell things down. So that's a secondary part of what they look at. And that also, given the track record of what we've been able to achieve, and I think they even mentioned that in their latest bulletin, I think we're very confident in that regard that with the levers that we have and the fact that we've done a lot of work around the country risk score and the diversified portfolio, we don't think there's a risk.
Thanks. And just lastly, touching on the timing of the announcing of the proposal of the merger with Oil Search, that obviously occurred the day after that call with Oil Search, which left a lot of uncertainties regarding the outlook for Oil Search for the rest of the year. Can you describe what was the driver for pursuing, for disclosing that merger right after that call, when we otherwise might have thought Oil Search's share price could have probably deteriorated in the wake of the call on the Monday, and you might have been able to pick it up at a lower price? What was the reason for doing it the day after?
It's a disclosure obligation, so we had no choice but to respond given Oil Search's announcement.
Okay, so there's no merit then to the reports in the press that it was an email or message from Santos on the evening before that's what triggered Oil Search to make the disclosure the next morning?
No, I'm not going to comment on what Oil Search's drivers were or internal communications between the two companies. But once Oil Search responded, we had no choice. Once they announced, clarification comment that they put out the next morning, we had no choice but to disclose, and we were just bound by our obligations.
Thanks, Jens. That's all from me.
Cheers.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Gordy Ramsay from RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Just a couple questions from me. Anthony, just on the CapEx,
Clearly, you've got a big spend coming up in the second half of the year. On my numbers, potentially over $1 billion. Can you just give us a feel for how that might be broken up? Is there any kind of two or three projects that are dominating that spend?
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. Yeah, you're right. The phasing for this year has definitely been pushed to the second half, and there's a couple of factors for that. There's some offshore spend in terms of the drilling campaigns, and obviously they're bigger and lumpier in our WA and Northern business. So that side of it's got a kick in the second half. And then in Cooper Basin in particular, we've bought the phasing was skewed to the second half due to sort of the phasing of joint venture budgets due to COVID. And we've just brought on a fourth rig in the Cooper Basin, which will be targeting oil wells. So we'll have four rigs going in the second half. So they're the main two drivers in the sustaining capex. So it will pick up activity during the second half with the obviously improved conditions post-COVID, in the middle of COVID, if that's a better way of saying it. And then in terms of the major capex, again, that's phasing. So Barossa's obviously really starting to gather steam now, having hit FID in the first quarter. So as a result of that, you'll see a bit more spend coming through as the phasing of Barossa and starts to ramp up as well.
That's good. Thank you. And just a couple other quick ones. PNG LNG, the scheme of arrangement requires shareholder approval. You've also mentioned that you'll require PNG National Accord approval. Can you kind of explain what that is and what's involved in that?
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. Yeah, look, the PNG court approval process is just similar to an Australian scheme. So it's pretty much based on very same legislation that we have. So instead of going to an Australian court as you would with an Australian scheme, you're going to a PNG court. But it's exactly the same process. So shareholder votes and PNG court approval process. And what was the second part of the question?
No, that was all. Just trying to understand that, whether politicians got involved and things like that. And just lastly, on Moomba, Beach has become your partner, which we knew, but there was or is an MOU with BP. Is that still there? Moomba CCS?
The arrangement with BP, yeah, that's still there today. And we also have a technical services agreement with Occidental.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Kevin. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Nick Burns from Jarden Australia. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Kevin and Anthony. Look, I might just follow on from Gordon's question around PNG. The Prime Minister's been pretty vocal there around the proposed merger, saying it must pass the national interest test. Just wondering, have you had any conversations with the Prime Minister around the merger proposal? And if so, what assurances were you able to provide him in relation to resourcing and support?
Thanks, Nick. Nick, I'm not going to talk about specific conversations we've had with anybody. However, what I will say is that commitments that we're very comfortable to make is that we'll continue with the level of in-country support for the social and community programs that Oil Search do support, because we think those are world-class and leading. And, PNG is a developing nation, a proud developing nation, and we want to be part of that story. So that's something that we see a lot of value in continuing, and so our commitment to that is absolute. Just to clarify one thing, though, I mean, I think you've got to be very careful when you quote what government have said versus what a journalist has said it might mean. And at the end of the day, what the governments have said is they actually see it as free market activity, but that any approvals would be subject to a national interest test. That's actually the same in most countries, and there's nothing unusual about that. And all the feedback we're getting back from government is that they see the benefits of it, they see the advantages and strategic alignment in country, they would want to see that commitment coming from anyone who's investing in PNG to continue investing in those programs and, of course, to be committed to growing, the Pathway LNG project, for example, and taking that forward.
Got it. That makes sense. Just another question on the Bayu-Undan CCS project. Can you just talk about how that would practically work? My understanding is the Barossa pipeline will tap into the Bayu-Undan pipeline from around mid-23. So just thinking about how you would run a CCS project from onshore with that tied in, would there be a requirement to duplicate that pipeline? And if so, who pays for that? And just also might just add on another question around that, just around the CO2 volumes. My understanding is most of the CO2 from Barossa will be vented offshore at the FPSO with around 6% coming onshore. So is it thinking to just store the 6% that's come to shore, or do you look to change how Barossa operates to try and capture more of that CO2 and look to put all of that through CCS as well? Thanks.
Well, the opportunity we're looking at, Nick, is to capture it all and send it all to the shore and then back up the bio and the pipeline. So what that would actually mean is actually instead of the Barossa pipeline tying in to the Bayu-Undan to Darwin pipeline, it would turn at 90 degrees at the tying point and run alongside it back into Darwin. And you bring so there'd be an additional section of pipeline required to make that work. And that's a very easy scope change. And it actually would mean a significant cost reduction to the Barossa project today, because you wouldn't be doing those subsea tie-ins, which would offset the additional costs of that pipeline. Now, who pays for the pipeline is another question, and which JV owns it is another question. But I'm not concerned about that. It's a case of whether you want to pay a toll or you want to pay for the pipeline at the end of the day, right? And depending on who owns it. A lot of enthusiasm for the project, though, by all parties. There's three parties involved here, three joint ventures involved, and two governments. You've got Barossa, you've got DLNG, and you've got the Bayu-Undan joint venture. And of course, in this case, when we take all the, if we take all the reservoir emissions back to Darwin, what that would mean is that Barossa has very, very little emissions, but Darwin LNG then gets all the emissions. And so Darwin LNG becomes the entity that under the current regulations would qualify for carbon credits by sending them offshore for injection and storage.
It sounds like there's a bit of a time factor here, given obviously FPSO is now under construction and you need to change potentially what the kit is on board. If you need to compress additional volumes to take it to shore, is that how we should think about it?
No. We designed the FPSO to handle the CO2 and be able to send it to the beach, and the pipeline was designed to take it from day one. So it was always designed with this possibility. What in actual fact it would mean is that we could take kit off the FPSO and reduce the power load offshore, which wouldn't be a change to power spec or to the spec of the power gen equipment. It means you're just running less power, right, offshore, which again reduces emissions. So it was always designed for the possibility in case we made that change later. This is more about an acceleration opportunity.
That's great. Thanks, Kevin. Cheers.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Daniel Butcher from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. I think most of my questions have been asked. Just maybe have another go on the financing with Anthony, if that's okay.
Sure.
You know, S&P put something out recently saying that if they see a lot of country risk with your earnings from PNG, which will only go up with Papua if it's FID. So I'm just sort of curious, if you give us a little bit more colour, perhaps, on what the internal banks were saying about what sort of share of PNG would be acceptable to S&P in their view. That's my first part of my question.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Look, as I said, we've worked a lot with the banks on the deal to go through the numbers on how country risk works and how the notchings for S&P work. And you know, it's complicated to go into on a call, but at the end of the day, I think the most important thing to say is, as I said, we're very confident that the diversified portfolio doesn't get restricted by PNG's country risk, and that we're still well below the hurdles that S&P set. So the balance of the earnings stream, the production stream, and the levers that we have available for us are all something that S&P look at. And from that diversified portfolio, it's actually quite stronger in that regard. So I think from that sense, we're, as I said, we're really confident that there shouldn't be any problems with that. It's just the bulletin that S&P put out was they're obviously getting a lot of questions similar to this one. And I think they were just sort of saying that at the end of the day, look, there is heightened risk around the PNG country risk, which is obvious. Doesn't mean that we're getting a downgrade. That's not what they were trying to say. And we're working closely with them, and we'll go through a process with them over the coming weeks and months to get comfortable and make sure that there's no issue.
I think that's right. I think it's important to note that we're just simply clarifying what they have to look at.
Yep.
Yep. But then they made a lot of supporting comments on the same bulletin about Santos's track record and Santos's portfolio.
Yeah, I guess one, if you could share with us, are there any other sort of moving parts besides PNG that you sort of think you need to change in your side of the business existing right now, which might be needed to stand those metrics?
No, look, to the contrary, actually, the existing business, the FFO to debt measures and all of the credit measures for this year are extremely strong, so they're flying. So from that regard, the existing business is well above the hurdle rates that we need. As I said, that bulletin was purely just focused on the heightened PNG country risk. Don't forget, we've also got Fitch, and you know Fitch have come out supporting our triple B credit rating, which is a notch above the S&P rating, and from that regard, they've already, and again, we've been in discussions with Fitch, and they're very comfortable with the diversified portfolio of MergeCo.
Sure. And this might be hard for you to answer, but just sort of curious, I mean, your combined market caps of Oil Search and Santos are sort of well below where they were, or no higher certainly than before the merger was announced, yet you're sort of pointing towards 60 to 100 million of synergies per annum, which could create, you know, a couple of billion dollars worth of value, especially if they're higher than that. So I'm sort of curious, what's your feedback from investors about why, or why is it that no one sort of seems to be believing the synergies in the combined share price of the two companies?
Well, I think the whole sector's down, Dan. You know, I think we've moved with the sector, generally speaking, and we haven't seen that response to oil price this year here in Australia. We've seen it more with international oil and gas. We just haven't seen it here. I think you've probably got a very strong view on that, as why that is as well. But ultimately, we just want to keep building value and creating a stronger company. And my belief is if we keep doing that and we build a much stronger balance sheet foundation for MergeCo going forward, that allows us to accelerate our plans for the transition, then I think ultimately that share price and that market cap will respond.
Great. I'm looking forward to seeing the synergies in early September, so thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Baden Moore from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning or good afternoon, and thanks for the question. Just a detailed one on the result today. Very strong profit number. Some of that came from a decent or a lower tax rate through the half. I was just wondering, is there anything one-off that's cycling through those numbers? Should we expect that to normalise through the year? Any more colour you can provide there?
Yeah, thanks, Biden. Yeah, look, there was a couple of things in the tax rate. So there was a PRRT one-off credit of $32 million, which was for booking of some Barossa PRRT credits on FID, so we weren't able to book them from a recognition perspective until we hit FID. That's you can see that in our normalised underlying profit calculation. So that $32 million is adjusted out of the underlying as a one-off, but it is in the tax rate. And then the other probably thing to call out was there's also some credits with regards to our asset sales of tax. So there's a $26 million hit, credit positive hit, I should say, for the sales to JIRA and SK of our Barossa and Darwin interests. JIRA has been booked as an asset held for sale under the accounting recognition standards because we're close to hopefully signing that transaction this half. So those two hits, the $32 million for PRRT credit for Barossa and a $26 million credit for the asset sales are the main differences. If you adjust for those, the income tax rate moves to around 25-26%, so it's pretty close to the 30% income tax rate, so pretty normal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Saul Kavanagh from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Sorry, gents. I forgot my most important question. Just wanted to check with you, Kevin. Any consideration to changing the name of Santos post-MergeCo?
Next question. Not really. I mean, I think at this point, as I've always said to people, you know, Santos stands for the South Australian and Northern Territory Oil Search Company. And so, you know, one of the things I think that makes us a good fit is the fact that Oil Search is already in our name.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, so.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Gallagher for closing remarks.
Okay, well, look, I mean, that concludes our Q&A session. Again, thank you all very much for your support and for your time this afternoon. And I look forward to catching up with many of you over the next few days in our roadshow presentations. Thank you.
That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.